Welcome back. Good to see you, good to be here. A couple of sort of introductory things. Our topic for today is the Book of Job, Theological Reflections on the Problem of Natural Disasters. I think one of the most basic things the Book of Job is about is natural disasters. For those who may not have been at the sessions yesterday or whatever, there's a handout that remaining from that. I'm not going to spend much time with this, but need another one? Okay. This. That's another couple more?
Yep.
Okay. And we're not going to look right behind you. Many time here, but we'll have occasion to look back and reference that. And then here comes the handout for this session. Okay, so, thank you. We looked at a little yesterday, and which lies behind the Book of Job, I think, significantly, is an understanding of creation. And one might state it in terms like this, I think, is God created a dangerous world. God created a dangerous world. And understanding of creation permeates more literature in the Old Testament than we might imagine. And the Book of Job is a major resource for continuing that conversation. God created a dangerous world. Law of gravity. Weather patterns. Water. Can't live without it, but it's dangerous. I mean, that's part of the rippling of this. And to come then to the sheet before you that was just handed out, the Book of Job, which I entitled Theological Reflections on the Problem of Natural Disasters. Start with that side and then move to the back. Let's skip down to the third paragraph initially. We'll come back to the first. The third paragraph, give a little background here. The Book of Job is once upon a time literature. It's not biography. It's not autobiography. Job is, I say here, a what-if book. A what-if book. Let's suppose for the sake of argument book. It's a dramatic tale designed to pose key questions about suffering, particularly, presenting various points of view. As you might find in any congregation to which you belong or any church to which you belong, varying points of view about this topic. And I'm sorry to say, but the Bible is basically responsible for that variance. Notice in parentheses there in that third paragraph, I say, just looking at the Book of Job, you find these perspectives. The friends of Job have one perspective. Job has another perspective, and they at each other all throughout. God has a perspective. God emerges in the scene finally in Job 38, And you get God's perspective on suffering. And then you get, I say, the prologue and the epilogue. Just a moment there. Prologue is Job 1 and 2. It's the prologue, the introduction to the book of Job. And the epilogue is from chapter 42, 7 to the end of the book in chapter 42. We'll particularly note the prologue. And the idea is that that prologue gives to us about the topic of suffering. And the prologue does a remarkable job of setting your mind going, where in the world are we taking this topic? In the middle of that third paragraph, in view of God's negative evaluation of the friends. And that's important to recognize. I cite a text there, Job 42, 7 and 8. It's, God doesn't, and I indicated, God doesn't enter into the conversation really until chapter 38 of Job, and then in chapter 42, and then the epilogue. But look at what God says about the conversation that has taken place in Job 42, verses 7 and 8. After the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, one of the friends of Job, quote, my wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. Now therefore take seven bulls and so forth, and the conversation continues, and go to my servant Job and offer up for yourself a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept his prayer not to deal with you according to your folly. For you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has done. Repeated. Okay, you got to wait to the end of the book to see what the author discerns with respect to the rightness of the perspectives of Job and his friend. And but what that ending of the book of Job does is, as I say in the third paragraph again, in view of God's negative evaluation of the friends, a key challenge of the book is to determine which point or points of view the writer is commending to the reader. You want is it the point of view of the friends? Let me tell you, in the churches, the point of view of the friends is the most common, in my experience. But it continues, it seemed, anyway, that's the question, what point of view is the author commending to the reader? It seemed at the end, last sentence, that it seems likely that they're centered in the God speeches, which will return, and I focus on two key sections of the book at that point. But let's come back to the top of the page. Questions here about just that's pretty, some pretty basic stuff with regard to character of the book of Job. But there were, anything you want to lift up or attend to on what I've said so far? Let's just know at any time, any place, raise some questions.
Jerry, let's come. One question I have isn't there? Are you taking this like prologue and the epilogue along with text as one author?
We don't know. I think it leaves us sort of open-ended. I mean, the scholarly work has considered, well, there's one author for the prologue, another author for author for the epilogue, and the God speeches, another. I mean, scholarly opinion is all over the map with regard to issues of authorship. I'm a final form critic, if you will, and so I take the book of Job in its present form and say, what do we have to do with here? And that's at least the form of the book that we're presented with. We don't know for sure about what other forms it may have had through the years, probably several, but this is the only one we know for sure. So I take that as a starting place. Any other questions? This one, yes, please.
So with the point of view of the writer being on the God speeches, could you also say maybe the point of view is with Job's integrity, with his questions and his willingness to ask, you know, and to go there with God in the midst of all the pressure against him?
Yeah, there's I'm not suggesting here that only one of these characters, like God, has an appropriate point of view. I think even the friend's point of view is appropriate with regard to certain matters. And Job, I think, as well. Job gets some things wrong, even though God says at the end, you've done better than your friends. Not quite that language, but it's just a Kilkeith. The book opens you up to differing points of view. It's like going to a Lutheran congregation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got different points of view that are out about on a whole variety of matters. The book of Job presents you with possibilities, and it wants to finally, you know, zero in, I think, on the God speeches, but not without recognizing the appropriateness of perspectives on the part of other characters. So come back to the top of the page and take it from there. I got a fly who's taken interest in this topic. We begin with the first paragraph. A key reason for Job's suffering is his and his family's experience of natural disasters. And Job 1 and 2, the prologue, lifts up the characters of that situation. I continue here. While the book lifts up both natural evil, now here's a distinction that's being made between natural evil, that is to say the ill effects from the workings of nature, windstorm, lightning, related fires, disease, that's the natural evil that Job experiences, and moral evil, human sin and its effects, and in the opening chapters of Job, it would be the actions of the Sabaeans and the Chaldeans, the foreigners who overrun the community and wreak havoc upon this family and others. But clearly, the emphasis is on natural evil. But I say the ill effects from the workings of nature. And so you can go to just One of the things that this ordering of the book invites you to do when you get to the end and you see God makes a judgment on the friends and Job, well, it sends you back to the beginning. I got to reread it in view of God's evaluation at the end. And so you go back and you look at it once again. And one of the things you know, can know, is again and again and again, people are talking about creation. The world of nature, and not least, natural disasters. And when God comes on the scene, chapters 38 to 41, from the bottom of the page, God's conversation with Job in the God speeches has almost entirely to do with nature, creation, and the relationship that the suffering. And so, if you just take a look at an example here, Job, in God's speeches, Job 38 to 41, but you should sit down some time and just lift up Job 38 to 41, particularly if you've got some science background or have a little interest in the natural order. I mean, chapter 39, just read a couple of verses, for example. Job, do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the deer? Can you number the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time when they give birth? When they crouch to give birth to their offspring and are delivered of their young ones become strong, they grow up in the open, and they go forth and do not return to them. Who's let the wild ass go free? Who has loosed the bonds of the swift ass, to which I have given the steppe for its home, the salt land for its dwelling place? It scorns the tumult of the city. It does not hear the shouts of the driver. It ranges the mountains as its pasture, and it searches after every green thing. God comes to Job and talks about nature. Excuse me, what kind of pastoral counseling is that? Yeah. With all this suffering that Job has endured and voiced his remarkable complaints, and God comes and talks to him about nature, world of nature. What sense is this? Presumably, the Word of God is a pretty decisive word in the book, huh? So, I continue in that first paragraph. Job begins by raising creation issues in chapter 3, once you get beyond the prologue, and the conversation between Job and his friend starts in chapter 3. The interactions between Job and his friends focus on interpretive issues regarding creation. Job's friend's opinion is, could go to any number of members in your congregations, I'm sure. Job's friend's opinion is, Job, you're suffering? What did you do wrong? Welcome, to a familiar topic in many a congregation, many of mine. Okay. So, again to that first paragraph, and God's response in chapter 38 to 41 has largely to do with meteorology, zoology, and cosmology. I read a little bit to you there. Remarkable topic for God to introduce to Job in the midst of this suffering situation. Questions there about that? Yes, please.
I always thought that first the friends of Job just stayed there and were silent.
Yeah, they were for a while.
Yeah.
But that changed in a hurry. Yeah. Or if not in a hurry, it changed in significant ways.
But I always thought that was really good.
Yeah, that response on the part of the friends who just come to be with him in the midst of the suffering and not have their voices fill the room. One could, I think, designate that as a helpful pastoral move. But they move quickly into conversation for chapters 4 to 37. Well, Elihu, the friend at the end, isn't at the beginning, but so. Other questions here? Yes, please.
Yeah. You said God gets into zoology and botany and all that stuff, but it isn't really God's response knowledge. You think you know better than I do? Where were you when I laid out the world?
Yeah. There is an issue of knowledge here. Maybe I could just delay that a little bit to get down the page. But just say right now is that when God comes to Job, what fills the room is God's questions to Job. And I want to just emphasize here two things one thing that God says twice in his speeches is to Job is, gird up your loins. Gird up your loins. Come on, Job. Better take a closer look at the world around you. If you come to understand that world a little bit better, you'll understand your suffering better. So then, remember, gird up your loins. Let's go look at the second paragraph. The central point that the book will make about the issue is this. Suffering, such as that of Job and his family, may occur because of the nature of the world that God has created. What I call the nature of nature. Because God, keyword, allows or permits the natural order to be what it was created to be, God created this world, God lets it be the world it was created to be. God doesn't interfere with the world and that kind of thing. It just lets it be what it was created to be. Released, I say here, released from tight divine control, and here I make reference back to God's resting on the Sabbath in Genesis 1 to 2. I just think that's such an interesting rest. God, at the end of the creation story, rests. God doesn't continue to act in the creation order. He lets the creation order be what it was created to be. I don't have to get in there and interfere with the way in which things are working. Let it be what it was created to be. And that's what the rest reference there. Continuing with that second paragraph, God created a world filled with risks. And we've mentioned water, law of gravity, weather patterns, and so forth. And God did not provide danger-free zones for the pious to be kept free from harm. Now Job thinks, God, for heaven's sake, what kind of world did you make here? And if you made this kind of world, why aren't you taking better care of me? Huh? So I say at the end of the second paragraph, much suffering, think of people you know who are suffering, much suffering is creation-based. Much suffering has reference to the way in which the world works. Begin with the diseases. Begin with the way in which the various effects of the world in which we're a part have on people's lives. Questions there with that? Yes, please.
I just want to clarify, because I'm old enough to have grown up with all these things began to happen after the fall.
Yeah.
And your premise, if I'm hearing you correctly, is that it happened in creation. There is no pre-fall, post-fall, death, disaster, sickness.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
I just want to make sure.
I want to say two things there. Basically, I would want to affirm the direction of your reflection. But I would also like to add that human beings in their activity in relationship to the world can intensify, make worse, the dynamic creational situation which God created.
Okay, that helps.
Okay, so you get two angles there. God created a dangerous world that's very, but human sin, in other words, human sin it is not originally responsible for the kind of world we have, which is dangerous. Okay? Even if human beings had never sinned, the world would be a dangerous world.
But we make it worse.
We make it worse. And there's an intensification, if you will, of these matters in view of human sinful activity. Good question. Good important. Yeah. Okay. Then let's continue here. Let's go. Let's drop down to. So at the end of the second paragraph, much suffering is creation based. Okay. If much suffering is creation based, what is your pastoral responsibility with respect to working with that suffering? Or with suffering individuals? If it's creation-based, fundamentally. If it's due to the fact that God made this kind of world, the people get hurt. That affects pastoral response. And it also helps us understand a little bit better the kind of response that God has to Job in the midst of all of his complaining and suffering. I made this kind of world, Job. Go with it.
Does God also, in a sense, when I hear and say, will you hear what I did that, he's actually revealing the wonder, the absolute magnificent wonder of this dangerous world. I mean, the birds that fly, the wild ass that goes and does what it does, and there is a wonderfulness about this world as well as a brokenness about it.
There is, there's a wonderfulness about the world, and whether you use the word brokenness, is that's up for conversation. You see, God originally didn't create a broken world,
no.
Even though it was very messy. All kinds of problems. But it does become more complex with human behaviors entering into the conversation.
I do have a comment. When you were talking about pastoral care, it seems like when there is suffering, one of the first things you need to make sure is that you don't blame that person, like you said, you know, like, what did you do that caused it or something?
But that's what Job's friends do.
Right.
What did you do, Job? You have many.
And a lot of people will kind of do that. But what I'm thinking, the other part that I think is so important is that even though there is suffering in the world, I know one of the prayers I do, I know God is always around, but help me feel His presence and feel that strength that He will help me through it.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's related to Job, but...
One of the questions that needs to be raised, at least, is that response of God, where God engages in conversation with respect to the nature of creation, in response to this suffering situation, how might that serve us pastorally in our own time and in our own place? It is remarkable how Job, the theology of so many church people is the theology of Job's friends. We'll look at the prologue. The prologue intensifies some of that a little bit, and that can be helpful. Look at the middle of the page then, the section on the prologue, Job 1 and 2. This section is often called deliberately provocative. Now, these are leading scholars now. Carol Newsom, whose office I used at Emory University last semester, wonderful Job scholar, M-E-W-S-O-M. Norman Hobble is the key Lutheran scholar coming out of the Missouri Synod forward-looking side of the Missouri Synod's foot. But this language here I have, deliberately provocative, outrageous, come from scholars of that sort. On the other side of this handout are several examples of such rhetoric, especially about God. And my question, we'll look at it now, is the author commending these points of view to the reader or not? Let's look over. And this page is a Xerox from my book on God and the World in the Old Testament, The Relational Theology of Creation. And I begin, are there others around who don't have this sheet? I began by raising questions regarding the kind of God the book of Job portrays. Job begins with a question about human piety. It's that wonderful. Does Job serve God for nothing? Or does Job serve God for what Job can get out of it? If I behave myself in a certain way, will I get certain rewards out of this? I mean, that's the question that's raised at the beginning. But that is almost immediately transmuted to include a question about the character of God, which the book pursues until the very end. A straightforward reading of Job lifts up several problematic portraits of God. And let's just look at these. Keep in mind, is the book of Job commending these points of view or not? Or presenting it as, there's this point of view about God, there's this one. So, which of these is the author commending? Now, first, God sets Job up for suffering by bragging about him to the Satan. Maybe just a comment there, I got it on the other side, but say it here. Don't go devil here. This is not the devil. Notice that it begins with the definite article, the. Proper names don't begin with a definite article. People don't call me the Terrence. And so don't go there. But the Satan, if you will, is an adversarial creature in the that works with God on many things. Number two, God is manipulated, and the NRV translates in 2-3 here, incited. Really? Do you want to say that kind of God you have to do? That God can be incited? God can be manipulated? Maybe. By the Satan, which is, I define it there, the most accusing voice in the heavenly counselor, but not the later devil. So we can somehow be helped. The Satan appears only in the prologue. The Satan never shows up in the rest of the book. Never even mentioned. Even in the epilogue. And so you got it's peculiar to then the providing an opening for this conversation. But the Satan, middle of two there, to allow him virtually free rein in visiting Job with suffering for no reason. Okay? One more time. Okay? What kind of God is this? I think probably a lot of people have a God like that. God is one who sends zaps here and zaps there, and if you get in the way of some of them, you're in trouble. And particularly if you behave yourself in a certain way, and do certain things, you may well be zapped. Okay. Number three, God is perfectly willing to sacrifice Job's children in order to score a debating point with the Satan. All those kids of Job are dead. And you can talk about at the end of the book of Job, Job gets more children, but they're not the children that he lost. Or number four, God is confident in Job, but Job does not know for sure how Job will respond under pressure. And according to this book, otherwise God could have overridden the Satan's challenge on the basis of exceptional knowledge, or the Satan would have so understood the situation. I don't know, maybe it's point of view. Can you buy that? Maybe not. Five, everything that happens comes from God. And this is monism, many a church member, and many a church leader is monistic. That's to say, everything comes from God. So all the suffering which we're having to do, with which we have to do, is God generated. That's a monism that I think is really sorrowful in the extent to which it pervades the minds and hearts of church people. There is one text in Job we should lift up here. Look, Job 1, starting 120 and 21 in Job. Job rose, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell on the ground and worshipped. He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." I have heard that text read at funerals. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Everything that happens, God wills. Now the question you need to raise, the book of Job raises with regard to this statement on Job is Job's theology right? Or is Job exploring some possibility? Or does Job have an understanding of God that you better give up if he's going to be on track here? So be careful of 1:21, not least in view of chapter 2, verse 10. Let's see. Well, let's start with 9. Then his wife said to him, do you still persist in your integrity? Curse God and die. Be thankful for Job's wife. I mean, she really gets it in there. But he said to her, now, he softens the perspective that he presented in 1:21. You speak as any foolish woman would speak. Have I ever said that?
No.
Okay. Shall we receive the good at the hand of God? Oh, back in 1:21, Job spoke of Yahweh, the Lord, the personal name of the... Here, he shifts to simply Elohim, the divine being. The personal reference to God disappears here. Okay. Shall we receive the good at the hand of the God and not receive the... Oh, I'm sorry. Let me go back to the beginning of verse 10. He said to her, you speak as any foolish woman would speak. Shall we receive the good at the hand of the God and not receive the bad? That question introduced, but it seems to be a development from Job's perspective that he presented in 1:20:21. Seems to move a little bit away from the less personal God. It's a more distant God that Job moves toward here. So the perspective presented back in 1:21, the Lord give, the Lord's taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord. Job seems to have given that up and moved on to another perspective already here in chapter 2 after more suffering piles on. So coming back to your sheet on number 5, the text says, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away, good and bad come from the Lord. Job seems to be moving with respect to that perspective. So be careful of how you use 1:21. Whose point of view is this? How does that point of view that Job utters in 1:21, how does it stand in terms of the author's final interest in talking about God? Number 6, for Job, throughout the dialogue, God is hostile and cruel, but inaccessible. Job complained, God, can't you run your world in a decent way? All this suffering that's around? I mean, God, why can't you take care of people better than you do? It's remarkable that the hostility that Job ascribes to God here. And it just piles on. God, it gets worse as you move through the interaction between Job and his friends. Number 7, for Job's friends and Job in the dialogue, God is a distant, aloof, heavenly accountant. That's an image of God that is relatively common in the churches in my experience. God is a heavenly accountant who only reacts within a retributive structure to which God is bound. You've done something wrong, you're going to get it. If you are pious, appropriate piety, then I'll bless you. I mean, just... remarkably common in the life of the church.
Again, I'm not sure about this, but it seems to me I've been taught that in the Hebrew concept, if you had good material wealth, if you were blessed and God loved you, which is then carried into Calvinism, does that tie into this at all?
Yeah, it does. The retributive theory with regard to Old Testament text, particularly in the prophets, but also reflected in Job. What role does judgment have on the sinfulness of people? So in particular, you get in the prophets, they say the idolatry of the people, the lack of care for the poor and the needy, the judgment. get me going here on God's judgment, but if God's judgment is built into the way in which the world works, you will suffer the effects of your sins. Now, not inevitably, some people will get away with it. That neighbor down the block who never goes to church, gets along much better in the world, got a lot more money than I do, you know, that sort of conversation. But it's God judges, God's judgment is the way, the reference to the effects that people's behavior has on their own life and the life of others. Yeah.
I read this book written by a guy at the University of Nebraska on the history of homosexuality in Western civilization, which really could be renamed the history of torture. But the whole thing and the premise was that every generation, especially Judeo-Christianity, blamed homosexuals for all natural disasters, any kind of problems in the culture. It was a retribution for their sin. Does that fit into this?
Well, that
comes
back. I
found that fascinating.
I couldn't go there with regard to that judgment, with regard to the gay community among us, but the we're always ready to find somebody to blame for the problems that emerge. And we manage to slip out from underneath any responsibility with regard to our own behaviors all too often. And so that's the kind of conversation that needs to be happening there. Go to number 8 on your sheet. God responds to a suffering Job with two long-winded speeches, 38-41, that rightly or wrongly would provoke a failing grade in most pastoral counseling courses. I mean, what are you going to do with this kind of response to suffering? The content may be one thing. The way in which it's spoken may be another. Coming to the bottom of the page there, this portrayal of God is troublesome for many Bible readers, and rightly so. Can God be trusted? Can God be manipulated? Does God bet on his best horses?
Yeah.
Huh? That's what Job. Does God send suffering, quote, for no reason? Is God insensitive to suffering people? Do God's ends justify any means? Is God responsible for everything that happens, good or evil? Does God know the future less than absolutely, whether Job can take the pressure? I look into several of these questions in the book, and initially I note that it soon becomes clear that the theological reading must take into account certain rhetorical strategies that have been used in this sophisticated piece of literature. And so that's what I've been talking about here, is what might be called a rhetorical strategy. We're going to get varying points of view that are presented to you in this book with regard to how you talk about suffering. Now, what are you going to do with these various points of view? So we turn back to the other side. But questions here?
Sure.
Let's look at the prologue. Maybe we did. Yeah, the prologue, Job 1 and 2, and we'll just work through that paragraph. This section is often called the provocative. And then the third line, is the author commending these points of view to the reader or not? Primarily on the basis of the prologue, the first two chapters, it is commonly thought by readers that God sends suffering directly into the lives of individuals to test their faith. Remarkably common. I suggest, rather, that the Satan, which we talked about, not the later devil, is a vehicle for portraying the idea that God lets the creation, lets, an important, God lets the creation be what it was created to be, and God's role then is permission, not management. Get to think of, God, if you have word allowed, God allows, God permits. Be careful with that word. Because so often you get a specific situation and God allowed that to happen. And that's not where the language of allowance goes here. God created the world and allowed the world to be what it was created to be. And that's often going to mean a lot of suffering and trouble, given the nature of the world God brought into being. So, what I say there, God's role is permission, not management. God allows the creation to be what it was created to be. God's not in there managing every little move that comes along. That's the reference here, I think, in Joel. And then to go to the God speeches, and we can open that up. God speeches in Job 38 to 41. But first, anything back on the prologue? Anyone want to raise here? Yes, please.
Just the whole issue that you're raising about God created a dangerous world.
Yeah.
Wonder if the problem, rather the problem for us, and maybe for Job, is that when things go so well for us, we can live in denial of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when disaster happens,
it hits.
Then you go, what's God doing to me?
Yeah.
You know, I always thought this world was predictable and good.
Yeah.
You know, then all of a sudden you're like, oh.
Well, that's basically one of the responses that Job has. God, I've been very faithful.
Mm-hmm.
Just read Job's. I've been faithful, God. You're not keeping your side of the relationship in a way you ought. Hmm?
And it's also kind of the Satan's question to God. Well, why wouldn't Job be faithful? Look at the way you blessed him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Sure, he's got it good. Will he take away some of those things? Yeah. Will he have faith?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, please, Paul.
Well, I'll just make a comment about the church, okay? Anecdotal, personal experience. Because I'm well aware that all these points of view are out there. In 2004, my father was out ice fishing, went into open water and drowned. And I mean, it's exactly what you're saying. I mean, there were articles in the newspaper explaining the patterns of the wind in shallow water, creating open spaces, even though it was bitterly cold. So I've heard this forever, you know, horror stories about the stupid things people say to the grieving, and I was really not in a mood to deal with it. But between the visitation and the funeral, I would venture at least 700 people and not a single comment.
Mm-hmm.
Other than, I'm sorry. Or mostly, nothing at all. Just an embrace. It was remarkable.
Yeah.
Because I really was very nervous about it. And wanting to be gracious, knowing people mean well.
Yeah.
But I think some of the critical work we're doing about what is not helpful theologically
is having a
maybe having an effect.
Yeah.
That people are aware that these glib answers really and it was not a particularly educated crowd. I mean, certainly some people were, but I just wanted to share that experience because we constantly get this caricature of the church and of unhelpful responses that I really had a very different experience.
That's great to hear. It would be interesting to be able to know who we don't.
Yeah.
If people other than your father had such an experience, might their response be different?
What do you mean?
That it's because of the relationship that they had.
That could be, yeah. I mean, my sense is that they were all as stunned and broken as I was.
Yeah.
Can I throw in something similar to that? My pastor growing up dealt with several suicides, and not in ways which were particularly helpful, until the day that his own spouse committed suicide. And he took the time, my opinion of him is raised when I heard this story recently from he did take the time to go to an individual and basically say, I'm sorry. Yeah. I didn't get it.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
Appreciate these testimonies.
Yeah. Just to add a counter example, though, my wife's uncle drowned, and in Minnesota, if you haven't seen a doctor in a certain time, you have to have an autopsy. So they did an autopsy and found out that he had pancreatic cancer. And many people said, well, that was God's way of sparing your uncle's son.
Yeah. Yep.
So, I mean, I'm really glad you had that great experience, but we have
I know other people have other experiences. The caricature isn't made up.
I've lectured on this topic now for 50 years. And the continuity of over those 50 years is remarkable. I think there is, I agree with you, that there is some greater sensitivity. I think it's contextual often. Who is it with whom we have to do? And but this tribute to understanding is all too common yet in the life of the church.
And the world.
And the world, yes.
People say it at funeral homes too.
Yes, of course. That's simply the truth.
I have an aunt who's 91.
Speak up just a little bit.
I have an aunt who's 91, and she and her husband, my uncle, lost two children in childbirth. And her portrait of God, it keeps her stuck. She's still stuck. How could this possibly happen? Yeah. And how could God allow this?
And it's allowed
and now
in
she's
a specific
stuck in
sense.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And now she's stuck in her own. Why am I still living? You know, she doesn't want to live anymore. Yeah. And so her understanding of God just is in total conflict with her stuckness.
Yeah.
But she hasn't been able to...
Yeah. Appreciate that. It's all too common among us, I think.
Yeah.
But I'm pleased for the exceptions.
Yeah.
Terry?
Yes, please.
Could you say a little more on the way you talked about allow and allow?
Yeah, very important distinction. I'm glad to push back on that. I think that... for many people, when they respond to a suffering situation of one kind or another, their use of the language of allow is God specifically allow this event or this illness or whatever the case may be to happen. So God's in there micromanaging these matters. And so that in other words, the language of allow is used with a kind of specificity. I think that's not so, and when we hear the language of allowing in the life of the church or anyone else, be careful, because I think that's a common understanding of allow. God specifically acted to allow this particular thing. But on the other, I want to use the language of allow, finally, but it's not specific. It's God created a world in which God allowed the world to be, to have this kind of effect on people. If diseases in God's world are part of the way the world works. Yeah.
I agree. I hear you using it very specifically, and I agree. What would you say to keep that from becoming a deist point of view?
Yeah. God, it's present.
Okay.
But the presence of God is important to affirm, I think.
Mm-hmm. And
but
compassionate.
There are all kinds of good word you can use with regard to that situation. But that the specific allowance is that there's a specific action that God takes and has these kinds of effects, if you will.
Kind of like this guy said about God allowed so-and-so to drown so he didn't have to suffer with pancreatic cancer.
Yeah. That's what I hear.
Yeah.
I don't know if they used the language of allowing. Right.
I think pretty much it was pretty universal. Oh, thank God, you know, God and His goodness. I know this is hard on you, but you know, boy, at least He didn't have to suffer. You know?
Yeah.
That seems to assume that there was this, that God allowed this thing.
Yeah, and kind of it's such an important distinction. Specific allowance and general allowance. The biblical material, I think, only has to do, except for points of view of friends of Job, of course, it has to do with general, God allows the world to be what it was created to be, and that's going to have negative effect. Just because of the kind of world it has, or it's because of people's behavior, there's going to be rippling effects that are going to travel down the journey with you. Yes, please.
God created the world good. And isn't it the case both in, I don't know Hebrew, but certainly in New Testament Greek, when the word good is used, that it has to do with that phrase that you've used before, that your good, the gift given to you that is good because it was created to work things out the way it was meant to work things out. I mean, that's the sense of good.
Yeah.
And I would assume that the creation story, good, is really saying that it's good, the creation is good because it will now work itself out the way it was meant to be worked out.
That sounds a little too deterministic for me, the way in which it was meant to work out.
Well, in your, I didn't mean it that way.
Yeah.
But
yeah, good. I think the title I give to that handout is God created the world good but not perfect. And one of the effects of that understanding of creation is that there can be these disastrous events that happen as just a part of God's world. We'll have to continue with this. There's a couple of paragraphs left on this page, and I'd like to maybe start there, and we'll continue with the topic of suffering tomorrow. So thank you very much. Good to be with you.